So I finished off yesterday by writing down something that you probably saw in the first GR course, which is essentially the reason why partial differentiation doesn't work for taking derivatives of vectors. So this was, I think, just about the last thing that I wrote down yesterday. And the first bit we noted was the sort of thing that we wanted. It was something that was transforming in a sensible, covariant way according to the sort of change of coordinates. But the second piece had something that just involved the coordinate transformation itself. And basically, what's going on is that in this case, T, the T mu are the components of the vector, and there's two reasons why these will change. And we just need one of those two reasons. The first reason T changes is because the vector field itself is varying throughout the manifold, and we can think of the first term as representing that information. But T is also changing because the basis is changing, and that's the bit that we need to kind of scrutinize and see what's going on there and see if we can somehow make that geometric. So let me just write some of that down. Oh, yes. Thank you. You are absolutely right. Thanks for that. Obviously, just been, I must have sort of blanked and did this, but thanks very much. So as I say, you've kind of been introduced to this anyway when you did the covariant derivative, but I'm just going to try and kind of pick apart, why things or what it is that doesn't work about the simple case and the different ways in which you can generalize differentiation. So the image here is that usually in differentiation, we're comparing things at nearby places. So our original limit of the derivative as you first meet it, when you first do calculus, is as taking a limit of a difference in a function at two points divided by the distance between the two points. And so in the manifold, that would translate to looking at two nearby points, P and P plus delta P. But we know that we have these tangent spaces at each point. So if we have a vector or covector, it's living in actually in different vector spaces. So the tangent space here is a different space. And so if you like, part of the problem is how do we sort of define a geometric delta P? So although P and P plus delta P are definite events, they have a geometric meaning, delta P itself is not a geometric quantity. So the one thing that we could do to define a delta P is that we could define a path from P to P plus delta P. So that would be geometric, But in that case, we have a definite root. We've got a definite curve. So our derivative would be limited to a derivative along a very specific curve. So we'll be coming back to that tomorrow because this is known as the Lie derivative, where we take a derivative by defining our delta p in terms of a small movement along a curve. So that's one way around it. Of course, you already know another way around it. Let's try it with chalk. Another way around it is that we can define further structure on our tangent bundle, and that's known as the connection, which you've already seen. And what the connection does is it simply gives a rule or a way of connecting nearby tangent spaces. So it says, if you like, if I choose a basis here at P, it becomes this basis here at P plus delta P. So that's our connection. Symbols. So those we'll do tomorrow, but what I want to do today is to look at a different way that you can take a derivative, something that really is quite different. Both of those ways of doing a derivative, in some sense, are quite natural when you think about what you mean by a derivative. You're comparing things at nearby points, so you have to think, how do you do that? In one case, you link the nearby points in a very specific way, and in the other case, you link the tangent spaces at different points in a somewhat more general way. But the other thing that we could do is we could be sneaky. We could look at this relation, and we could say, okay, so we've got a piece we don't want, but that piece is a second-order partial derivative. And so that means it's symmetric. So could we somehow find a way of cancelling off that term by making things anti-symmetric? And that's what the exterior derivative does. It's an anti-symmetric derivative. So the gain is that we define no further structure on our manifold. The loss is that it only works on anti-symmetric objects, and they're called forms. So that's what we're going to talk about now. My writing does seem to be a bit bad in the 9 o'clock in the morning. So when I was thinking about this, I noticed that when you ask one of these rhetorical questions in a lecture and you put something down with a question mark, typically when it's in a sort of lecture-type environment, the answer is almost always yes, whereas if you notice the title of a paper with, you know, does this work, question mark, the answer will be no, because if it did work, they'd be saying, hey, look at this, this is how it is. So, you know, it's kind of almost the inverse. So let's start just by noticing that we've actually already defined a derivative on, you know, just from partial derivatives on our manifold. And that derivative is a derivative of functions. Now, we used a derivative of functions to kind of bootstrap our way up into a definition of a vector, some geometric tangent vector. But now that we've got our vector space and our cotangent space, we can kind of, instead of saying that, you know, the vector acted on any C, you know, function on the manifold, we can sort of do it in reverse and say, well, if we're given a specific function, we can take its derivative and use a vector to kind of tell us what that means. So our derivative is taking a function f, and if I write it in a coordinate chart, it looks like this. So we take f, and we take its partial derivative with respect to the coordinates in a particular chart, and then we match that up with the covector basis, the coordinate covector basis. So this object here is a covector, and we kind of see, because we've got this sum over the mu here, that if we do a coordinate transformation, it's still going to look the same. So this D here, that as I've defined it, takes a function and maps it into an element of the cotangent bundle. And we have written it down here in a sort of what you're quite used to from the previous notation, but formally, the way we would define it, we would say, well, if we take df and take any vector, then that would be t acting on f. And this would be true for, you know, for all t in tp of m, and, you know, basically across the whole tangent bundle. So wherever you focused in on, your df would always, if you contracted it with a vector, give you tf at that point. So now we're going to extend that to covariant tensors. So we want to have an antisymmetric derivative, and so what we really need to do is restrict ourselves to tensors that are antisymmetric. And so we're just simply going to define what we mean by these antisymmetric tensors, which are called forms. So we form these antisymmetric tensors by an antisymmetric tensor product. So this is the wedge product. So if we have two covectors, A wedge B, then we would construct the wedge product by saying that A wedge B is A tensor B minus B tensor A. It's kind of sort of the obvious thing that you would do for an anti-symmetric product. So these two here are both covectors, or now we'd call them one-forms. But obviously, the overall product is a two-form, anti-symmetric, second-rank covariant tensor. So we generalize this. If I have a p-form and take this wedge product with a q-form and ask what are the indices, you know, what are the components, then the components of A wedge B, you simply put A and B, take the components of A, put them next to the components of B, and then just anti-symmetrize over absolutely everything. So can I just check, have you seen this notation? I'm sorry I couldn't access the lectures from outside PI. So you've seen the notation. So you know that when you see a curved brackets, it's a symmetrized set of indices. If it's square brackets, it's anti-symmetric, and these are just combinatorial factors. So you are, because this anti-symmetric bracket here would have 1 over p plus q factorial, right? So that's what that's doing there. And then the p factorial and the q factorial are kind of taking out the fact that, you know, the reordering of these indices gives you the same component up to a minus sign. So these are simply combinatorial factors that kind of take care of, you know, of what you've got. So up here, you know, you would expect to see sort of AABB minus ABBA. It just makes the numbers kind of work. So here we now have a non-commutative product. It's not quite anti-commutative. It's obviously anti-commutative on two one-forms, but in general, if we've got this a product of a p-form and a q-form, then if you swap the p form and the q form, you get a minus sign if pq is odd. And you can sort of see that from here, because if you swap a and b, you've got to kind of move every single b index through every single a index. So if either of them have an even number of indices, you don't get a minus sign. So another consequence of this anti-symmetry is that we can't go on taking the wedge product ad infinitum. We have a cutoff. The wedge product can only work if the rank of our form, in other words, how many indices it's got, is less than the dimensionality of the manifold. Because if it became more, you would always have a repeated index somewhere, and therefore it would be zero by anti-symmetry. So the N form, let's think about that for a moment. If we have something which has the same number of indices as there are dimensions of the manifold, then that means that however we, you know, whatever we do, we're only ever reordering indices. We've kind of used up all the degrees of freedom. And so our object has to be unique up to a factor. So it's actually a multiple of the alternating symbol, which is probably something that's familiar. And epsilon, let's say if we're in 4D, so our alternating symbol is simply plus or minus one or zero. It's zero if any of the indices repeat, and then it's plus one if they're an even permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3, or a minus one if it's an odd permutation. And again, choosing this to be plus or that to be minus is a convention. Doesn't, you know, you could choose the other as long as you're consistent. So this isn't actually a tensor. It's something that's called a tensor density. The fact that it's anything like a tensor at all should be a bit surprising given that it's just plus or minus one. So if I tried to form an object by taking, let's keep to four dimensions for the moment. So let me take this alternating symbol and contract it with the basis. So I make a four form out of my covector basis. Then if I do a coordinate transformation, so if I do a coordinate transformation, then my basis, covector basis, changes. And it changes in the obvious way. Dx mu goes to dx by dx prime times dx prime mu prime. But then if I just ignore this, what I have is the epsilon tensor contracted with this matrix dx by dx prime. And so that's simply equal to, that's the definition of a determinant, times the alternating symbol in terms of these new primed indices. So what you see is that you've got something that looks like the tensor again, and then you've got this weight, which is, in this case, it's just the determinant of the coordinate transformation to the power one. But that's what we mean by a density, a tensor density or vector density. It's something that transforms almost like a vector or tensor under coordinate transformations, but it also picks up factors of the determinant of the transformation. So in this case, this would be a density of weight one, but you know, you can have situations where you get different weights. And so what this means is that having gone through this process, I can see that I can now cook up a real bona fide tensor using this alternating symbol, because all I need to do is multiply by something that when you make a coordinate transformation has the opposite weight, has weight minus one. So if we have a metric, so what we do is we, so notice I've got two different fonts for my epsilon. One is a sort of somewhat cleaner, like a sans-serif font. That's just the alternating symbol. But if it's a curly epsilon, then what it actually means is you take this alternating symbol, and you multiply by the square root of the determinant of the metric. Because under a coordinate transformation, the determinant of the metric actually picks up a factor of dx prime by dx. So in other words, it's got the opposite weight of this alternating symbol here, the tensor density. So you put the two together, and then you see that under a coordinate transformation, the curly epsilon does actually transform as a tensor. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I guess normally we wouldn't want to make, you know, in terms of typically when we look at coordinate transformations on a manifold, you know, in terms of a general coordinate transformation, we don't change parity. So, you know, we're not really thinking about reflections in that case. So our general coordinate transformations, again, I'm not sure to... Yes, it's definitely orientable because we're thinking, you know, of something that we kind of live in. And again, I'm not sure precisely what you covered. But typically, when we think of general coordinate transformations, we're sort of just thinking of relabelings. But we also know that they're generated locally by vector fields. So, and I'll be kind of using that tomorrow. So a coordinate transformation, you know, is just a relabeling. And if we think of just a tiny shift in our relabeling of coordinates, what does that mean? So we can think of, you know, sometimes I carry an image of a set of scaffolding as my coordinate system because that's a sort of very visual way of thinking about Cartesian coordinates. And then my transformation is kind of taking this structure and just nudging it here and nudging it there. And so that sort of has this interpretation of the vector field. So that's clearly a continuous transformation continuously connected to the identity. So in that case, we're fine with this, yeah? So, you know, there's a lot of situations where, you know, if you look at just the mathematics of manifolds, you can get sort of various other, you know, different thing, you know, different properties that can come up. But I'm, you know, just like we've said C infinity as well, you know, you can have non-C infinity manifolds, but we're kind of going to be, you know, looking at things which correspond to sort of solutions to physical equations. So, yeah. So I guess, you know, it's I'll sort of keep the theme of having a metric for just for a moment, but I just want to stress that we don't actually need a metric to think about these forms, or indeed to think about the exterior derivative. So the metric, I guess, in the context of this language, we would think of as a symmetric bilinear map. From two copies of the tangent, tangent space at a particular point, I mean, obviously over the total tangent bundle, into the reals. So we would take two vectors, u and v, and map them onto the contraction of g with u and v. Now, the fact that it's symmetric means that if I swap the order of u and v, I get the same thing. So this is really where we come. This is sort of providing a sort of inner product. Now, it's not just symmetric bilinear. Typically, we want it also to be invertible, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because we want it to have some sort of physical meaning as distances between points. But the reason why it's nice to have a metric when we're thinking of forms is it gives us a little bit of extra structure, and it also allows us to define that epsilon tensor. And essentially what the epsilon tensor can do is it can take a P form and give you an n minus p form, simply by, if I look at it in terms of components, taking the components of the p form here and contracting those with p of the indices on that epsilon tensor. So what this is doing is over the whole manifold, this Hodge dual, as it's called, or the star operator, is just taking us between forms of different dimensionality. And the way that we do it, it would take A as a P form to star A, which would be an N minus P form, and in components, star A would simply be, as I say, you take the epsilon tensor now and contract the components of A. So that's really why you need the metric, because you can see not only do you need it in order to define the curly epsilon, but you're kind of using the metric, or the inverse of the metric, to raise those indices on the epsilon tensor. So this is called the Hodge dual, and it's actually the reason that we can do sort of standard vector calculus in three dimensions, because if you're in three dimensions, then a one form is dual to a two form. And so you can kind of see how, if we're claiming that we're going to take an anti-symmetric derivative, we're going to be hopping from a p form to a p plus one form. And so we take a one form, would go to a two form, the dual would take us back to a one form. So let's see how we do that by defining D. So once again, we're defining it as a map. And so in component, yep.
Mm-hmm. Some sources define, like for example, I give you a set of anti-symmetric units like f mu nu.
Yep.
And they say like, okay, define the tensor, the form as being like 1 over 2 f mu nu dx mu wedge dx mu. They divide by the, like 1 over p factorial when you're defining the form. And then I think that also kind of extends when you define the Hodge dual. So like I'm not sure, because Wikipedia apparently gives like a different normalization there. That's why
1 over n minus p because it's n minus p for the end.
Okay. So in this case, the reason for the p factorial is because you're summing over those p indices. Okay. So they have p factorial different ways in which they can be rearranged. So you kind of need to cancel that multiplicity. So that is saying that in that particular case, you're not counting repetitions according to those reordering of those in B indices.
Right. Mm-hmm. For your epsilon tensor, then it's a kind of like there. You've never divided by n factorial, for example, like some people do.
I don't think I've ever seen the epsilon tensor with a 1 over n factorial. Why don't we look at it afterwards, see it in context, because it might be that what it's doing is something just marginally different where there is a combinatorial factor coming in. So let's look at it, because sometimes you can think you've remembered one thing and it's... So in this case, that p factorial is simply sort of cancelling off those reorderings of the B indices. So in this case, when we take our anti-symmetric derivative, if I look in components, my p form A goes to, I have to admit, these combinatorial factors, you know, they keep coming up all the time, and that's why I always, you know, always have to double check what I write down. So in this case, you take the partial derivative of A, completely anti-symmetrize. And so again, if we just sort of try and think about what the combinatorial factors are doing here, the p plus 1 factorial is cancelling off the 1 over p plus 1 factorial that comes from the anti-symmetrization bracket here. And the 1 over p factorial is taking care of the multiplicities coming from reordering of all of these indices on A. So in this case, what this means is that if A is a one form, then D of A is just A comma B minus B comma A. So it's simply got two terms in it. If A is a two form, dA, actually, if you wrote it down, would have three terms. If A was a three form, then, oh, okay, now my combinatorics, I'm very bad at combinatorics, but anyway, there are more terms. I shouldn't have said that, I can't remember the number. And I'm still too jet lagged to do it in real time. No, because you have to make sure that it's, you know, that it's actually going to work, you know, in a well-defined sorry, I mean, if you didn't put down these combinatorial factors, for example, you'd end up with lots of multiplicities here coming from reordering of these indices on A, which is already anti-symmetric. And then you'd also have that 1 over p plus 1 factorial coming from the square bracket here. So let me just put as an aside, what d of a 1 form in components so it's two derivatives, yeah? I mean, two terms. D of a 2 form and so on. So it's simply that this is, you know, They look funny, but when you actually sort of write down what's going on, they make sense.
If you write down in that way, like, is that the concurrent factor?
Sorry, I missed the last bit. In the last.
You wrote p plus 1 factorial divided by p factorial, which is just p plus 1.
Yeah, I did. That's true. But it's easier to see why it would be p plus 1 by writing it this way. So the reason I write it this way is it's kind of to explain why you're multiplying by p plus 1. It's saying that, you know, here your p plus 1 factorial is kind of going along with this square bracket, and the p factorial is cancelling off reorderings of these indices. By all means, write it as p plus 1. It is the same thing. But if you just wrote it as p plus 1, the reason why that factor is there would be slightly more obscure, at least to my mind, maybe not for you. No, this is what they say. This is what D of B is. So the reason being that this one's sort of a bit too trivial to see why it's working. This one's perhaps a better one because there's something more going on, but not so much that you're writing down lots of different reorderings. So here, your anti-symmetrization over three indices would normally have 6 terms, right? So it would be 1/6. And then all 6 permutations of ABC, together with some minus signs, corresponding to whether they're odd or even. But then what you would notice in those 6 permutations is that you have the reorderings, you know, in terms of the anti-symmetry of B, would pair them, would put them together pairwise. So they would all then match up. So you'd then sort of be knocked down to 3, but then, so you'd sort of then have a kind of, you know, a third, but then your factor of 3 from this combinatorial prefactor would take care of that third and just bring it to this, in this case, you know, cyclic permutations. Yeah, so I mean, that was where I was saying, I was assuming that you'd, or at least you said that you'd met this before. When you have a anti-symmetrization or symmetrization, you know, for example, sort of A1 to AP, anti-symmetrized, it's 1 over P factorial, sum over permutations of the you know, the P indices times a minus sign of the order of the permutation, yep. So, okay. So at the moment, I've just said, I've told you what the map is, but actually you can uniquely specify by saying that it's a map such that D reduces to DF on functions. And It's what we'd call pseudo-Leibnizian. In other words, derivatives you expect to be Leibnizian, so you would expect there to be a sort of what you mean by Leibnizian is simply if you've got a derivative of a product, you take the derivative of one, then add the derivative of the other. But in this case, this would be dA wedge B, and then it would be either plus or minus, depending on the rank of A wedge dB. So it is Leibnizian, but there could be a little minus sign hiding in there. So in fact, just those properties there, that it's a map between P forms and P plus one forms, that it reduces to D on functions, and that it satisfies that sort of Leibniz property, that actually specifies the exterior derivative. So if you try to construct something satisfying those properties, you would end up with that expression that I wrote down for the components. So I just want to finish off by just giving some very familiar examples of this exterior differentiate. Oh, one more property I forgot. Most important one of all. D acting on itself is zero. So I just want to do a couple of examples which illustrate the application of these forms, but you know, probably you were doing forms without kind of realizing it. So we're going to use this Hodge-Dual operator. And what it does is it simply says that if you've got a P form, take its dual, you get an N minus P form. Take D, that gives you an N minus P plus one form. Take its dual, you go back to a P minus one form. So this maps P forms to P minus one forms. And what it actually does is it takes component wise, takes a sort of divergence. So let's just look at these examples. So the first one is very familiar, and it's actually just simple vector calculus. So normal 3D grad, div, and curl. So if we have a vector, let's take its exterior derivative. So if I looked at what I wrote down over there, it's anti-symmetric, so obviously everything on the leading diagonal vanishes. So, yeah, I mean, in this case, it's actually, you'd sort of, yep. It's just easier to write it as covariant, because I know you know what a covariant derivative is. So it's basically, because the epsilon has the root g in it, you pick up some derivative of that, and it's just easier to represent it as our normal Levi-Civita connection covariant derivative. So if I look at component by component, so D, it's over there. If I take D of V, it was simply the partial derivative with respect to the first index of the second component of my vector. So down here, I simply get minus of what I have here. And here I've got so that's what my exterior derivative is of a vector in three dimensions. But if I take its dual, so what that means is I take my epsilon tensor, epsilon ABC, or XIJ for the first component, and sorry, that's you can read that. So if I do the dual of this, I find that what I get back is a vector, and the first component is the derivative with respect to the third coordinate of the second component of V. And this is just curl V. So if you go ahead in terms of standard vector calculus, again, when you kind of do vector calculus, you often want to know, for example, I'm just telling you what it is in Cartesians, but you often want to know how standard grad div curl, et cetera, work in different bases, such as, say, spherical polars, then, you know, this is a way of actually simply getting this using just an alternating symbol and things to do with root G, because, you know, here you're taking, you know, I've expressed this there as just sort of anti-symmetric derivatives, but as I say, the for example, the divergence of V is that delta operator. So again, you sort of, you can kind of use these expressions to see how you get the normal three-dimensional vector calculus expressions in different bases. So something else I should just say, having defined delta, is that a harmonic form satisfies d delta minus delta d. So this thing is really the wave operator or the Laplacian, depending on the signature of your space-time. But again, it has an expression in terms of these exterior derivatives. So normally, you know, I mean, I've said that there's a metric, but, and I did write down, as I was pointed out, the covariant derivative. But in reality, all we're ever really doing is taking derivatives of the determinant of the metric. So my other example that I just wanted to mention, because again, it's something that's very familiar, is electromagnetism. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, but that was what, when I was asked about it, I said, what that short, that covariant derivative there is really shorthand, because what it really is a partial derivative of the determinant of the metric, which is the same as the standard Levi-Civita covariant derivative in acting on that form. So I've written it like that because it's kind of something that I know you're familiar with, but it's shorthand. In reality, what you've got is a partial derivative plus a derivative of the determinant of the metric, which is the same as the Levi-Civita connection term with indices summed over. So it was probably unwise, clearly unwise, to take that shortcut. So in electromagnetism, it's a gauge theory, so we can write it in terms of a gauge potential, which is a one form in terms of the language that we've been developing today. So it's a covector field, and in terms of notation that Maxwell might have been more familiar with, you've got your electrostatic potential and the vector potential. And so the field strength F is simply the exterior derivative of this. I realize there that I've used the same symbol for two different things. Derivative of the one form. So in this case, I get, again, zeros down the diagonal. And so I complete my F using anti-symmetry. And what we kind of see here is that the derivatives in terms of anything that's an FTI gives us the electric field. And then, of course, the purely spatial parts take us back to vector calculus. And so it takes us back. The purely spatial parts are like the curl of this A. So that's the B field. So we've automatically get half of Maxwell's equations. From df is zero. So d squared is zero, therefore d of f, since f is dA, has to be zero. So those are half of Maxwell's equations. And then our gauge invariance is simply A goes to A plus D of a function, and then F goes to F plus D of D lambda, which is just F, because D squared is zero. I'm just going to kind of put this out there because I think it's something that you should be seeing a bit later if you do the string theory course. But we can generalize to higher forms. So I've already said what a two-form, the exterior derivative of a two-form is, but if B mu nu is a two-form, then our field strength, H, is now a three-form. We have a gauge invariance. B goes to B plus dA. And so we can sort of construct this gauge theory of higher rank forms. And so why would on Earth would you want to do something like this? Well, if you've got electromagnetism, we know that that couples to point charges. So if I were writing that down classically, I would say I would have a term in my Lagrangian, which was an integral of Q times A dotted with the tangent vector of a world line. So B mu nu couples to strings. So if I now have a world sheet, I get B mu nu x dot mu x prime nu. So this would be x dot, and that would be x prime. So you can obviously, if you get higher rank forms, that corresponds to coupling to higher dimensional objects. So that's kind of just throwing that out there at the end. So forms are actually quite an important, you know, part of the more formal end of theoretical physics, but they're also an example of structure that we can put on a manifold. And although I've talked about having a metric and have used the Hodge dual, you don't have to use the dual operator. You can still do exterior derivatives, and you can still have all this structure without a metric. So I'll stop there so that the boards can get cleaned.